This morning, in this hour, Focus 580, we'll be talking about politics in the Middle East. And our guest for the program is Anthony Shadid. He was recently Cairo correspondent for the Associated Press. He's a winner of an Overseas Press Club citation in 1997 for a series of articles that form the core of a book that we'll be talking about this morning. The title of the book is Legacy of the Prophet, the subtitle Despots, Democrats, and the New Politics of Islam. And what he argues in the book is that when you look at Islamic politics, you can see there has been a change as people have moved away from militancy and toward democracy. And I think that he would argue that it's a change that has been going on some time now, but perhaps a lot of the news coverage that we get of the Middle East and of Islamic politics generally has not reflected this change. And that's behind his interest in doing this and talking about it. He was also formerly news editor of the Associated Press Los Angeles Bureau, and now he is correspondent in Washington for the Boston Globe newspaper. And he's talking with us by telephone. As we talk, your questions are welcome. All you need to do is give us a call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line that's good for you if you would be having to make a long-distance call. We'll pay for the call, 800-222-9455. So, again, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. At any point, if you have questions, comments, you can call us. Mr. Shadid, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, I'm just curious, you're posting to the Middle East being a Mideast correspondent. Did that have something to do with the fact that you are Arab American, or was that just an accident?
Well, it was definitely a lifelong interest. It's something that I'd wanted to do since I was much younger. I'd spent years learning Arabic for that purpose. My parents are Lebanese, but I didn't grow up speaking Arabic, so it's something I had to go back to school and learn. And spent some time in Cairo, actually, in the early 90s on a fellowship. So, it was always in the cards to go to the Middle East.
Mm. And I'm interested, at some point in the book, you talk about the fact that perhaps being Arab-American was something of a help in trying to understand the politics of the Middle East. And at the same time, because you were an American, you truly weren't Arab, that you felt in some way connected and yet able to maintain some distance.
Right. And I think, I'm sure a lot of hyphenated Americans have the same feeling that you feel. I mean, I felt much more Arab in the United States, but much more American in the Arab world, and it's something I always carried as a reporter. Plus, my family was Christian, so I didn't share, the Muslim faith with the people that I interviewed often, and that also added another, I think, nuance to the relationship. Probably more important than anything, though, was Arabic, and speaking Arabic did kind of, I think, gave me a window on on people, on conversations, on trends that I might not had otherwise.
Yeah. Do you think that here, this trend that you're talking about in the book, the trend making a movement away from militancy and toward other sorts of strategies to achieve political goals, is that something that you feel that a lot of the media has missed?
Well, I almost think it's counterintuitive. And I think if you ask most Americans their images or their impressions of the Middle East, it is, and you mentioned this in the introduction, it is this idea of violence, of terrorism, of clashes and bloodshed, almost like that people over there have a penchant for violence. I think the latest thing was the bombing of the USS Cole off the coast of Yemen, but even before that, the bombings of the embassies in Africa. And then almost kind of an association in the popular mind with, between Muammar Gaddafi, for instance, in Libya and terrorism, or Saddam Hussein, or the Iranian Revolution, all these, they kind of get jumbled up even when they're not, don't necessarily have a direct link to Islam or the faith. My sense in spending the years over there and in putting the book together was that I think there are some very vibrant currents within political Islam that are being overlooked, and they're being overlooked just because of the nature of journalism, I think. I think we spend our time covering the news, and the news tends to be the dramatic and the violent. And so these kind of trends that I was looking at in the book, this idea of moderating, of embracing democracy, of looking for coalitions, of actually offering hope for politics over there, that tends to get overlooked because it's not as exciting.
Yeah, well, and certainly I know that this is something that grieves Muslims greatly, that somehow in the minds of so many people, their faith gets associated with violence, and it may indeed be, as you say, just a matter of if someone a suicide bomber, that's going to get a lot of attention. But if you look at groups that are working to try to, say, in nonviolent means, to improve the lives of people in refugee camps or places where people are disadvantaged, that's you could argue that's a story, but that's not going to get the kind of coverage that a bombing is going to get.
Probably not. And it's, you know, and by no means do I want to make the argument that there is not terrorism that is carried out by Islamic activists. There obviously is. There's no question about it. But I remember one person pointed out to me, and I thought it was a really good point, was that, you know, granted there is terrorism that is committed in the name of Islam, but at the same time, you know, we wouldn't say what David Koresh, for instance, did in Waco is somehow representative of Christianity, or what Farouk Goldstein did in the massacre in Hebron in the West Bank is somehow indicative of Judaism. And I thought it's a good point, but that by the same virtue, we wouldn't say what Osama bin Laden does is somehow speaks to the nature of Islam. And it's a point, at least I took it as a point well taken.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's, when you mentioned this idea of it might be a story, but it might not be, I remember I was spending time in Lebanon a couple of years back, and I was doing a story on Hezbollah. I think probably a lot of listeners remember Hezbollah from the 1980s. This is a group that, you know, bombed the U.S. Marine barracks, kidnapped foreigners, attacked the U.S. embassy. I mean, it was pretty much, I think, in a lot of Americans' minds, the symbol of terrorism in the Middle East. What I was doing when I was a reporter in Lebanon was trying to look at what Hezbollah was doing, you know, that went beyond that. And in fact, it really kind of has shed this terrorist image, at least in Lebanon. I think most Lebanese see it as, you know, probably as a social group, maybe a political group, you know, also a guerrilla group, and then that it was fighting the Israelis in southern Lebanon and for most of the 90s. But in Lebanese minds, it's definitely a political and social group. And trying to get that across, you know, as a journalist, as a writer, was difficult. And I ran into a lot of misperceptions by editors.
Hmm. And you also have written some of the same things about Hamas.
That's right. Hamas definitely is a group that still, elements of Hamas are still engaged in I think what most people would define as terrorism. There's no question about it. That's not the complete picture of the group. And I guess it depends on how much do we want to understand, how much do we want to appreciate what exactly is going on. And I think if we do want to get the broadest, most complete picture, we need to see what Hamas is doing as a political organization.
Let me, at this point, maybe I should just real quickly introduce our guest again. We're talking with Anthony Shadid. He's a journalist. He has worked for the Associated Press. He's been a foreign correspondent. He reported from Cairo for the AP. He also was the Associated Press Los Angeles, was an editor at the AP's LA Bureau. Right now he's working for the Boston Globe as their Washington correspondent. He spent a lot of time in the Middle East and North Africa and West Asia talking with people there, and has put together a book titled Legacy of the Prophet. Westview is the publisher, Westview Press. It is in the bookstore now if you want to look at it. And questions are welcome to 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. What I would like you to do is talk a little bit about what we mean or what you mean when you use a phrase like Islamic politics. And I think here, is something of the root of why it is we have such difficulty disentangling the faith from the actions of the people who profess it. And it seems that in other cases, there is not this close association between the religion and politics. So we don't, one might in this country talk about, for example, Christian politics, but we don't really talk about that very much. But certainly we do talk about Islamic politics. What exactly does that mean?
Well, I think it's a good point to raise, because it's something that I wrestled with definitely in the book. I think a lot of the time I spend in the books, you know, making the point or making the observation that Islam itself is one of them. It is a faith of breathtaking diversity. I mean, to call Islam the same in Afghanistan and Egypt, for instance, it's a hard argument to make. There's obviously, you know, similarities in doctrine and the core beliefs of the religion, but how it's practiced, how it's, you know, its history, its traditions, they're incredibly different from country to country, even within countries. So I think you're right. It's something that can be overgeneralized and can lead to, I think, a lot of misperceptions. My feeling was that political Islam was, or Islamic politics was, you know, was a movement that sought to carry out political or economic or social change within the framework of the religion. They were using the religion as the justification for those changes. And I think by no means is political Islam, you know, the same across the region. But it does speak to similar things. And my challenge in the book, I think, was to find out how there are those similarities, how there are those trends that join disparate movements in different countries, and bring them together. And I think there are points that they do share across borders, you know, across languages, across cultures.
Mm. Well, that let's go to that point, because that was going to be my very next question. See if you could talk a little bit about what it, given the fact, acknowledging the fact that we probably too often talk about Islam in monolithic terms. So acknowledging the fact that it is different from place to place, the people are different, their base cultures are different, their concerns are different. There seem, though, to be some common threads and reasons for the fact that so many people, particularly young people and well-educated people, have been drawn to Islamist movements.
Uh-huh.
What is that?
I'm
stumbling a little bit there. Basically, that's the question. What is it that has drawn people into these movements?
Well, I think, you know, first and foremost, political Islam is the language of opposition in the Muslim world today. And I speak about that, you know, from Turkey to the Arab world and beyond. Maybe after World War II, even before World War II, there was anti-colonial movements, there were leftist movements, Marxism, communism spoke to frustration, anger, and opposition. I think today, if you're looking for a language of opposition, it's encapsulated within political Islam. And there's a certain flexibility that brings, because opposition, by its very nature, is flexible. I mean, it is opposing different circumstances, different governments, different conditions, and I think that flexibility makes political Islam so viable. You know, I think kind of wrapped up in that is really how we look at, you know, the constellation of power in the world. I mean, when I came home to the United States in 1999, it struck me how much confidence the United States has. I mean, we're rarely ashamed of our actions. We're rarely, you know, apologetic about what we do on the world stage. When you spend time in the Middle East, the Arab world, or the Muslim world, I'm always struck by the insecurity that is there. It's almost always a big concern over reputation, over how they look to other people. And it's very different from what you see, I think, in the West, which is, you know, obviously the most powerful region in the world. And I think political Islam feeds into that idea, that there is a feeling of being under siege, of being overwhelmed by Western culture, Western power, the military, economy, social institutions, and that. And political Islam seeks to counteract that, to somehow preserve culture, traditions, and heritage. And that can often, in a lot of instances, that's just a personal feeling. I mean, that never gets turned into politics, but often it is turned into politics, and it can be a very powerful current because it speaks to the very, you know, very essence of a person's identity.
We have one caller to bring in, and I'm sure we'll have others. Let's start by talking with a person in Champaign, line one.
Hello. Well, perhaps I'm calling a bit too soon because I wanted you to talk, perhaps, about what you mean by this democracy. For example, when I think of developing democracies in the Arab world, perhaps I start thinking of these newer, younger leaders in Jordan or Morocco or Syria or Bahrain, maybe Bahrain being the best example, when people having voted in some democratic forms. But I don't know how this relates to Islamic politics. That's number one. Maybe Islamic politics has put pressure on these younger leaders who are also many times educated in the West. But the point I want to get to, but maybe you need to go via that route first, is with Islamic politics, as you just said, there's a kind of return to culture, tradition, heritage, which sometimes, you know, means a return to the veil, which I don't necessarily think means, you know, I don't equate that with, you know, some kind of negative position necessarily for women. But within the idea of, you know, a greater democracy, perhaps through an Islamic model or through legacy of the Prophet, what do you see the position in the late 90s and early 21st century for women? Are they making progress? What kind of changes are being made? Or are they being left out of this process?
Yeah, those are good questions, both of them. When you talk about, what do we mean by Islamic politics, you know, democratic politics, I think you're right. There's a vast amount of change going on in the Middle East right now. You pointed out some examples, Bahrain, Syria, Jordan, no question about that. My sense was that when we talk about how political Islam is changing, how it's interacting differently with the governments, it's more on the level beneath the actual taking power, and I think that's a key point. I think in the past, the Muslim Brotherhood being a great example, movements sought to overthrow the government. They were going to institute their vision of a society, and that was going to be an Islamic society. It was going to be changed from above. What I was struck by, you know, in my time as a journalist there was change from below. And I thought a lot of these movements had kind of disavowed this idea of we're going to seize power, we're going to institute our vision, and instead they were seeking to bring about grassroots change, change that took place from below, that was much more gradual, and I think a lot more effective in a lot of instances. And let me just use the Muslim Brotherhood as an example, because this was probably the first and by far the largest Islamic fundamentalist group, formed in the 1930s, and it's enjoyed a prominent role in Egypt and other Arab countries since then. Today it's undergoing serious changes, sweeping changes, both within the group. I think it's opening itself up to more dissent and criticism, but also in the way it's interacting out with groups, other groups in society, both secular and religious. And I think that's a key point. They're willing to make coalitions. They're willing to enter into elections. They're willing to compromise on their positions. They're basically becoming an actor in a pluralist landscape. And I think that's a stunning change from what we saw even 10, 15 years ago. And I think that's happening elsewhere. Hezbollah in Lebanon, for instance, entering into elections, participating in debates in the legislature, compromising what positions might alienate other people. Jordan, another example of this. Turkey is another example. So I think we're seeing these groups start to say that we don't have one vision of Islam that must be instituted, but rather accepting the fact that there might be many Islams and that we can compromise and negotiate over what that Islam means in terms of their own program. And then in terms of the greater society, the society at large, they're saying that we don't have a right to, institute our program at the expense of all other programs. And I think that's a huge, hugely important change, and one that's still it's still nascent in a lot of ways, but I think if it does have a chance to, to flourish, it could speak to a different region in its entirety.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that they are building more tolerance for so-called different Islams, as opposed to like the Taliban, who has its notion and are absolutely convinced that that's the only way to go.
Exactly. We've seen the failures of that. I mean, Sudan and Iran being the best examples of that. I mean, in the past, that's been the blueprint to change, revolution. And what happened in Iran? I mean, Iran and Sudan are, it's hard to even compare them, but both countries had an experience in which a revolution or a coup d'etat brought an Islamic vision to power. It was a totalitarian vision. It prided itself on saying that we are the one vision of Islam that must be instituted at the expense of all other visions. And I think it's been a disaster in both those countries. And I think Iran might change to the degree where it's viable down the road. But Sudan's already failed, obviously. I mean, the architect of that program is in jail now in Sudan. I mean, it's failed to that degree.
But what about if these groups like the Muslim Brothers that have been around since 1928, if they become, sort of making coalitions and a part of, the system, then does that just make other people say, well, they're a sellout, they're not pure, and then, bring about other groups?
I haven't seen that. And obviously there's a potential for that. I didn't come across that at all. That doesn't mean, I don't want to say that there's not strong divisions over this path. I mean, what happened with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt in the mid-90s almost wrecked the organization over which direction we're going to go with this. And it's been, I think a lot of members were very alienated by that. I haven't seen this kind of reaction where you all are sellouts and now, we're going to go back to the war path. I haven't seen that at all. But there's obviously a potential for that. I don't think this is going to be a smooth transition by any means. I think it's going to be very troubled. And I think a lot of governments haven't embraced it yet either. I think a lot of governments are very suspicious about this direction, and they still think, Egypt is a great example. I think the Egyptian government still says, these guys still want power, we need to be careful for them, and we'll throw them in jail, whenever we see a threat.
Okay, well, speaking of women then, perhaps, women got more education during nationalism and certain rights in the workplace, but at the same time, they didn't necessarily have as many changes in, like, personal status laws, divorce, and things of that nature, travel without permission from husband, etc. And then then they became the Islamist period. And you're saying that there's some move out of that or some change. So what do you see as the position for women under this kind of new outlook?
Well, in terms of when we're talking, the veil is such a politicized issue, and it's so much I think it's a lot hotter issue in the West than it is in the Muslim world, but it definitely is one of those flashpoints. And understanding that was a flashpoint, I did try to pin people down, the activists that I was talking to, how do you guys stand on this? They often would support the veil. There's no question about it.
Yeah, I'd like to go beyond the veil. That's
right.
Something on the outside, but but other issues about women's power or participation.
Right. I mean, what I was struck by, at least when in movements that I came across, Turkey, Egypt, Iran even, and I don't want to say Iran's a movement, but what's happening in Iran is an incredible degree of activism on the part of women. Iran's a great example of changing personal status law. There have been some changes, obviously. I mean, Iran is nothing like, you know, Saudi Arabia, for instance, but even in the Gulf, you're seeing women take a much more assertive role in trying to bring about changes, again, on grassroots, in a gradual level. Across the board, I saw women participating in these movements to the point where the movements would pride themselves on the level of women's participation. You know, and I don't want to argue that the role of women over in the Middle East or in the Muslim world is the same as it is in the United States. There's no question it's not, but if anything, I was struck more by the fact that they were taking an aggressive role, taking an assertive role, rather than the opposite, that they were being, you know, oppressed, and you know, that first struck me much more than the latter.
Right. Well, we'd never expect it to be the same as in the States because the whole structure is different. But I was just wondering if there was any kind of movement in kind of structures, which I guess you're saying that at least people groups are priding themselves on women's participation. Although I was wondering if that was true participation or maybe they like to have this appearance of, you know.
Well, I think there's a little of both. No question. The women that I met and the women that I dealt with, I was definitely impressed by. But both in the commitment to what they were trying to do, and also in the power that they were exercising within the movement. It's still a male-dominated movement. There's no question about that. I mean, I don't think I think there's a long way to go. But I guess my point is just that. Kind of what I'm getting at is that it was almost counterintuitive. I mean, to me, what I would have expected was very little participation, but in fact what I found was a lot of participation. I guess that's what struck me most in dealing with that.
And are women being able to get some of this power by saying, well, back in the 7th century, women were actually very vocal? And I mean, are they doing any kind of reinterpretation of the earlier period, or are they, I mean, is it only like Islamicist women, or is it women in general that you feel are becoming more active?
I mean, well, I think, you know, it's an interesting point, because I think what it drives at is that, you know, to me, political Islam is anything but a retrograde movement. I mean, the movement itself very much, you know, positions itself as a modern movement, that we have a modern vision for life, that we draw on our culture, on traditions and history, but we're going to create a modern alternative, something that can compete with the West in a lot of ways. And I think women's role is positioned within that vision. It's not, you know, we're going to go back to, you know, 200, 300 years ago, but in fact, we're going to find out how you can be a modern Muslim woman. And that often means educated, that often means politically active, that often means assertive. And I think that's the way, you know, it's being positioned that way. There is some reinterpretation going on, but I think more it's the struggle to define what role a modern Muslim woman has, both in the movement and then in society at large.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. We're about at our midpoint here. Our guest is Anthony Shadid. He is a correspondent for the Boston Globe newspaper. Before that, he worked for the Associated Press. He was a news editor at the AP's Los Angeles Bureau, and before that was Cairo correspondent for the AP. He's the author of a book titled Legacy of the Prophet, Despots, Democrats, and the New Politics of Islam. It is published by Westview Press. It's in the bookstore now if you want to look at it. Questions are also welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Just for a second to return to a matter that you touched on, I'm sure that some of the people involved in these movements, those that have taken up an armed struggle, would say that they were forced into doing it because the governments of their countries, many of them decidedly undemocratic, saw these movements as a threat and very aggressively moved to crush them before they could gain strength. And I'm sure that there would have been a time when these groups would have said, well, yeah, it'd be swell if we could compete in an open election, but the government won't let us.
Right, great point. You know, and I think that's, you know, we often focus and key in on the violence committed by Islamic groups in opposition, and there's been a lot of violence, no question about it. But these governments, you know, Egypt, for instance, I keep on going back to Egypt because Egypt is so important in the Middle East, but, you know, Egypt gave very little room for dissent within society, and I think it has to share the blame for the violence that was carried out over the past 20 or 30 years. It struck me, one of my last, it was actually the last visit to Cairo, I met a guy named Kamal Habib, and he was a deputy leader of the group that carried out the assassination of Anwar Sadat, the Egyptian president, in 1981, and he was put in jail for 10 years he was only he was not executed just because his role wasn't, you know, he wasn't actually directly involved in the assassination. But I interviewed him in 1999, and he was remarkable because he was trying to create a new political group, a political party actually, and take part in, you know, in the politics of the society around him. And this is, it was a remarkable change. And here's a man who was put in jail because he tried to, you know, help plan the assassination of the Egyptian president. Today he's trying to form a political party, and he made that very point that you were just saying, that, you know, back then we were young. There was, the government was not going to give us any chance to, you know, to operate politically. There was no chance for change except to take up arms. And, you know, whether you you agree with it or disagree with it, that was definitely the perception at the time, and there's some truth to it in terms of the level of government repression. Now he sees a different, you know, climate. He also thinks the violence hurt the movement. It was wrong. You know, it smeared the reputation of Islam, and so he's, you know, there's other reasons that he, you know, he had a change, but it does go back to that idea that there was very little room for maneuver, you know, 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah. Let's take another caller. This is Champaign County, line two. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen, and I'll have to bring up these 2 points and then let you talk about them, and I won't be able to engage in any repartee. I have to go. But one domestic thing I'd like you to treat, and I think it's, since you're in Washington, you're probably watching this, but could you comment on our Reverend Falwell's remark about they'll be out the door with regard to Muslim groups applying for the faith-based funding? Now, I think he said some other things, too, that I actually haven't read the first article or the actual transcript on BeliefNet. I think he's actually saying things that other people are thinking, so people are distancing themselves from what he's saying, but I think the image of Islam as the terrorist is so preponderant that we're left with that. And the other thing is, in the occupied territories in Israel, and before Israel existed, even the British were doing the same thing that they did in India, and they did as a colonial power, divide and conquer, and played religious forces against secular forces, played them off against each other. We have on the record that before PLO was recognized as somebody to talk to, which it's less now than ever again, but the Israeli government under even Shamir, I think, was funding Hamas as a counterbalance to the secularists and the PLO supporters. So it's a complicated web, and I'd like for you to explain that. It's something that isn't treated often in the press here, and I'll have to hang up and let you sort those out. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks for the calls.
You know, I haven't read the transcript of Falwell's comments, but you know, other people have talked to me about them. I find it shocking. I really, and you know, the caller may be right that is a certain, there is a certain feeling among a lot of Americans about Muslim groups, but I just, you know, I find it hard not to see that as something so chauvinist or so racist that it wouldn't be acceptable if we used it for any other group in society. And again, I'm not a Muslim. You know, I come from a Christian family. But when people were telling me about Falwell's comments, I just thought the idea if somebody referred to Jewish groups or Christian groups that way, it would be unacceptable. Very bottom line, it would be unacceptable, and the criticism that would result would be awesome, I think. And I don't think there's any different standard that we should hold to Muslim groups. And it you know, it does strike me. Coming back, like I said, after 5 years away, you kind of lose a little bit of perspective. And I have come back, and I think there is almost a part of the American psyche that has a, not a revulsion maybe, but a very deep suspicion of Islam, of political Islam, of Muslim groups. And I think we as journalists share a certain responsibility for that, that our coverage and the way we've framed the events going on abroad have contributed to that. And by no, I mean, and again, I don't want to suggest that there isn't terrorism committed in the name of Islam. There is. I do caution that we don't overgeneralize and try to, you know, use that as a broad brush across the entire faith, religion. I mean, you know, a billion people. He brings up the point about Hamas, and that's a great point. And actually, it's in the book. And I talk about the Israeli government support for Hamas in the 80s when the PLO or the Palestinian National Movement was seen as a much bigger threat to the Israeli government. And I think it's something you see time and again when, you know, movements that are seen to compete with a bigger threat are funded or helped or supported. And here's a good example of that, where Hamas was helped by the Israelis, and it served, you know, it backfired really bad, obviously, in the 1990s.
Mm-hmm. Well, after all, the United States supported the Mujahideen in Afghanistan when the Soviets were occupying, because that was the Cold War. The Soviets were our enemies. So the enemies of our enemy are our friends. That's the, often the way that things go. And now look at the people that seem to be most problematic here for the United States. They're the those people who fought against the Russians in Afghanistan, or a lot of people who went there, got their training, and then they went elsewhere.
That's right. That's a great point. I mean, and you know, and nobody, I mean, back in the 1980s, when you read the press coverage, when you talk to journalists who dealt with that, when you talk to even, like, you know, diplomats and officials who were involved with the Mujahideen, nobody predicted what would happen. And you're right. I mean, the people who are responsible for acts of violence against the United States right now are almost drawn exclusively from that group supported by the CIA that fought in Afghanistan in the 1980s, almost exclusively. I mean, it is remarkable that they were trained, supported, and backed by U.S. money, and now they're, you know, they're avowed enemies of the United States. Hmm. It is remarkable.
Maybe I should ask you to talk about some place. Give us any. We've talked about this trend, this move away from militancy toward democracy, toward a kind of a posture that says revolution really needs, instead of coming from the top down, it's coming going to come from the ground up, and people who are working in a grassroots political sort of way. So give some good example that would show how that can work.
Let me tell you the best example, and I keep on going back to Lebanon, but I think it's one that probably a lot of listeners are familiar with. Lebanon was gripped by a civil war that lasted 15 years, 1975 to 1990. It was, you know, I mean, the name back in the 1980s, I think a lot of people remember, just almost signified or suggested anarchy. I mean, it was a rough place back then. Hezbollah, an Islamic movement, you know, supported by Iran, actually, you know, it was kind of created by Iran in a lot of ways in 1982 after the Israeli invasion, rose in that environment, in that anarchic environment. And it, like I said, it carried out these acts of terrorism in the 1980s. In the 1990s, it shifted its focus to fighting the Israeli occupation in southern Lebanon. At the same time, it used these resources from Iran and its own resources to create this just vast network of social institutions, hospitals, dental clinics, pharmacies, schools, nurseries. I mean, the list goes on. It is a remarkable array of institutions meant to help people and help people in the absence of any government help. I mean, the Lebanese government just, you know, it was a wreck after the civil war, obviously, and it couldn't do those same things. And that's when I say, when if you ask a Lebanese, you know, ask most Lebanese, especially in the south, what is Hezbollah? They'll say, well, it's the group that operates that hospital around the corner, or it's this group that operates the school that my kid goes to, or it's the movement that has opened this pharmacy where I get my drugs. And I think that association with Hezbollah as a social movement is a powerful one, and it's one that's given the group a remarkable degree of support, and one that it has used in elections. I mean, Hezbollah has less than a dozen, but it has, you know, several members in parliament who work with leftist groups, you know, trying to, you know, put issues of labor, put issues of, you know, of workers, of people suffering under the economic conditions there to the forefront. I mean, that in itself is kind of interesting that it's able to create those coalitions. But it's a group that operates as a political and social movement. Now, I think a lot of people in the United States, and the U.S. government obviously still considers it a terrorist group, and I think sometime down the road the U.S. government's going to have to reassess that, say, well, Hezbollah was involved in terrorism. There's no question about that. I mean, the group denies it, but there's really little question that it was not involved in terrorism. It's a change movement today. It speaks to a large portion of the Lebanese population. It's effective. It operates politically and socially. And, I mean, I guess the question becomes, do we reassess our policy and our position toward this movement? And that's really the questions we're going to be facing 5 or 10 years down the road. Do we consider looking at these groups in the context of what happened 20 years ago, or do we start trying to encourage their participation in a society as an actor in a pluralist framework and encourage that, you know, for the sake of better democracy or a more just system in those countries.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to have you talk about Iran. Here is a country where the relationship between Iran and the United States is certainly problematic, and as are relationships between the United States and other countries in the region. But here this seems to be a case where enough people in this country who are involved in the foreign policy establishment continue to talk about, to raise the question, are there things that we can do to improve this relationship? And it's still very difficult, although some people hold out, I think, hope for the fact that within Iran there seems to be a great debate and wrestling between people who are more conservative and people who are less conservative, although maybe by our standards, less conservative would still be pretty conservative. How is this going, and what is the possibility that we might see a more moderate kind of government in Iran, and one where the United States could have a constructive relationship with them?
You know, Iran it's a fascinating place. It was next to Sudan, it was my favorite place to travel to as a reporter. There's so much going on in Iran, and obviously Iran is a country of breathtaking culture and history. There's no question about that. But even in terms of what's happening today, there's so much energy. There's so much so much activity going on about trying to define what is society going to be in Iran and down the road. Can we have an Islamic democracy? Basically, is the question being asked. And I think you're right. I think it's too early to say which direction it is going to go. My gut sense is that President Khatami is going to succeed in a certain level, and he is going to be able to bring about. I mean, his campaign is for the rule of law rather than the rule of revolution. You know, in the revolution, nothing was for sure. You could be thrown in jail the next day. He's trying to create a society in which law is supreme, and that, you know, it's a battle that's not won by any means yet. And there's an election coming up again, and whether he wins or not, I think is going to have a lot to say about whether his reforms succeed. And I think you're right. I think the United States government is starting to sense that Iran is no longer this monolithic, symbol of Islamic militancy. I mean, that we are starting to see nuances and diversity of opinions and attempts at reform. And it's a tough position for the United States to be in, because if we overly support that, I think that could almost work against the reformers in Iran, who there still is a little bit of a stigma to be too closely associated with the United States in Iran. So it could almost backfire. And it's a tricky policy for the U.S. government to negotiate. I think they've actually done decently well. I think, getting rid of all of the sanctions is probably going to be better, because the economic conditions there are such an important issue. But I think we're seeing, our policy reassessed toward Iran much more than we're seeing it reassessed toward other countries and groups in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems that one of the hurdles that we have to get over, that is, the United States government has to get over, what we've done in the past. And unfortunately, it seems to be the case that when it comes to foreign policy, Americans have pretty short memories. But places elsewhere around the world, their memories are much longer. And you don't have to go back for example, in Iran, you don't have to go back that far to look at how the United States was involved in the installation of the Shah. That's not very, very long ago. And certainly Iranians remember that, if Americans don't. And, the West, not just the United States, but but the British and others in Europe were certainly involved in the region, in the Middle East, going back, before World War II, maybe even before World War I, when they were playing the great game and going in there and creating countries and drawing borders and carving out what bits of influence they could. The people there remember that very well, and it's going to continue to be a problem probably for the foreseeable future.
That's a great point. I tell you, every American, I'm sure, remembers, the taking of the hostages at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, and as we should. It was an important event in our modern history. At the same time, I think very few Americans would remember that, the U.S. government's role in overthrowing Mossadegh, the Iranian nationalist prime minister, I think in 1953. It's not, most people probably don't know Mossadegh's name. Every Iranian knows about it. It is a part of Iran's, national memory, and it's an incredibly decisive point, and I think you're right. I mean, there's this misunderstanding that goes on both sides, and I think we do have to appreciate that just by our sheer power, economic, social, military, we exercise an incredible degree of influence over the rest of the world, and the world is very sensitive to that fact. And I think that goes beyond the Muslim world, to be honest.
We have about 7 or 8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I should introduce again our guest. Anthony Shadid works for the Boston Globe. He's a Washington correspondent for that newspaper. Before that, he worked for the Associated Press, was news editor in the AP's Los Angeles Bureau, and before that was Cairo correspondent for the Associated Press. He spent a number of years reporting on the Middle East and put some of what he learned into this book that I mentioned, Legacy of the Prophet. The publisher is Westview Press, and questions are welcome, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, folks. But no matter where you're listening, if it would be a long-distance call, 800-222-9455. I think in the press coverage of people who are involved in violent political action, we have this notion that there are connections between people who operate in different places, or maybe the case is that there's a lot of movement of people. At any rate, there is this notion that we have that they are networked. Is there also now networking going on with the kind of people who are working in this other way? And are they making contacts with one another, talking about the fact, here we're doing this and you're doing this over here, and establishing some sort of ties that go across borders?
That's interesting. I think there is an awareness, probably more than a practical networking going on. For instance, President Khatami in Iran, what he's saying and what he's doing has had an effect on the Arab world. And Iran is a country that speaks a different language, Farsi. It practices a different sect of Islam than most of the Arab world. But at the same time, what President Khatami is saying is so universal in so many respects that I remember activists in Egypt would say, oh, you know, what he said was, that's what we're talking about. That's the direction we want to go. So I think it's probably more a sense of people listening and learning rather than actively engaged with each other. And that's, you know, there's a whole host of reasons for that. Politics, it's difficult for Islamic activists to travel in a lot of countries because they're, you know, they're under suspicion. There's language, of course, there's culture, these types of things. So I think there is an awareness across borders, probably more than a practical day-to-day interaction.
One of the things that seems to make really difficult sometimes talking between, again, acknowledging that this is a vast sort of overstatement, talking about the Islamic world and the West as if these were two, you know, solid identifiable things. But having said that, what seems sometimes to make that conversation difficult is the tendency, it seems, on the Muslim side of identifying themselves almost in opposition to the West by saying, one of the ways we talk about who we are is by saying we are not them. And that there seems to be so much conflict around issues of values that it seems difficult sometimes to find any sort of a common ground to have a conversation.
I think that's right. I think, you know, it's almost negative identity. We are not this.
Yeah.
You know, therefore we are this. You know, and I think that's there's definitely a certain truth to that. My sense of it is that that there is a sense of being so overwhelmed, of so under siege, that it's hard to break out of that. But even then, you know, what I think you're saying, you know, people identify themselves vis-a-vis the West. I think there's a certain, there's definitely truth to that. There's also truth to the fact that there's an incredible appreciation for the West. And that's why this understanding of the West is so, you know, so tied up in so many conflicting emotions. I mean, the overwhelming majority of Muslims admire the West for its military and economic prowess. I mean, it is the single most powerful, you know, again, you're right. I mean, we can't just say it's one thing, but, you know, the countries that make up the West are the most powerful and the most prominent in the world. And there's an appreciation and almost an envy of that. Then that's mixed up with this threat that they sense in Western culture, you know, that it is going to overwhelm us. It's going to make us no longer Muslims because we're going to, you know, adopt their manners, their outlook, their perspectives. So it's a tough one. And I think, you know, I think you're right. There's an overgeneralization on both parts, on both the West and the Muslim world. But I also think it's tied up in almost this, you know, this kind of love-hate relationship as well.
Yeah. Well, it seems that at other times and other places around the world, people have looked at Western culture and have asked this question, is it possible for us to adopt the positive things and not the negative things and maintain the essence of our culture and yet use whatever the West has to offer in a positive way? And sometimes it sounds as if within the Islamic politics, people are saying the West has nothing positive to offer and that there is no way that we can take anything because anything that we might take from the West is somehow polluted.
Right.
And if we bring that into our home, so to speak, then we've opened a door that we may not be able to get closed again.
And I think you hear that much anymore. That was definitely the sense, like even democracy. We can't import democracy because democracy is Western. You would hear that a while ago. I rarely ran across that today. It was more, democracy is good, but let's interpret it, you know, in our own terms. I mean, it's interesting when you make that point because when I was doing research on the book, I ran across references to how Chinese and Japanese intellectuals were facing the same issue. How do we borrow the West's technological prowess but leave its culture behind? And it was the same debate that I was hearing in a lot of countries in the Muslim world. How can we take one thing but leave the other? And that's an ongoing debate. And I think there's a certain energy that comes out of that search, you know, a certain flexibility and vibrancy that, you know, how do we define this stuff on our own terms? You know, not that we disavow everything that is Western, but instead look at it, you know, appreciate it, understand it, and then try to adapt it to what our needs and our challenges are.
Yeah. Well, just we're at the point where we pretty much have to finish, and maybe I'll just ask this. In so often in a conversation like this, we hear from our perspective, say, how are these people going to change themselves so we can have a better relationship? And we should at least be spending some of our time saying, all right, now how are we going to change the way that we think so that we and they can have a better relationship?
You know, and I see it as it's going to be a long process. I really, like I've said, I think there is a certain part of the American psyche that's very suspicious of the Muslim world, of Muslim countries, and of political Islam, and I think it's going to be a long process. I think just, you know, the more that we're open-minded and are, you know, accepting of changes that are going on and trying to, you know, better understand and better appreciate those changes, that's a huge first step. And if that happens, I think, you know, I think there is hope down the road.
Well, I want to thank you very much for spending some time and talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Our guest, Anthony Shadid, he is, as I've mentioned, the Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe newspaper. And if you'd like to read his book, again, it's titled Legacy of the Prophet, and it is published by Westview Press. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from B&W Photo Corley Photography, providing portrait, wedding, and commercial photography services and portrait framing. B&W Photo is located in downtown Champaign at 118 West Walnut, 351-6222. Tomorrow morning on the show, we'll be doing our regular monthly program on personal finance. Usually we do these shows with David Sinnoh from Strategic Capital Bank and Trust, and he's not able to be with us this month. We've got an able substitute. Kevin Waspy will be here. He's a lecturer in finance at University of Illinois, and we'll try to do the same kind of program. If you have questions about your investment strategies, you can call in. Then in the second part of the program, we will be speaking with Michael Brenson. He's professor of curatorial studies at Bard College, and we'll be talking about the visual artist in America. He's written a book on this titled Visionaries and Outcasts that, among other things, looks at the